Hello, good afternoon. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday afternoon, the 19th of April, and my name is Paul Gallagher. I have as guest today on the show Marsha Baker, who's the for the second week in a row spearheading major coverage in the Executive Intelligence Review this week on the global food crisis. And also up in Montreal, Rob Ainsworth of the LaRouche Youth Movement, who actually is talking to us directly from a table deployment, from a deployment out in the field, out in the street in Montreal, where he and other members of the LaRouche Youth Movement are organizing in the middle of this very crisis and in a very sensitive nation from this standpoint, one of the world's biggest food exporters and also one of the world's most British-dominated political histories. And this is what we're coming to. Everybody is reading now that the a severe global food crisis has erupted directly from the financial collapse, which occurred and has been worsening since the middle of last year. The financial blowout of the monetary system has apparently led directly into the worst crisis of food production, food consumption, and food prices that anyone can remember. And so the world's press are full of this now. There are riots which have been reported in something like 35 countries around the world for the inability to get or the inability to buy food. And this is something that Lyndon LaRouche has been made a major part of his political activity and his proposal of economic solutions for more than 30 years. Lyndon LaRouche right now today and yesterday is in Mexico. He's in Monterrey, the engineering technical university center of the country. He's been speaking at the Monterrey Technical Institute and also with a group of supporters of a huge water project, water management project for the western part of Mexico, in order to put the drenching water in that part of Mexico to work at something else than floods and to put it to work at irrigating and producing much more food. That's LaRouche's approach, has been for a long time. But let's get to the immediate and severe crisis that we're in now. Marsha, to start with you, LaRouche has called this a famine in process of developing, and he has blamed it directly on the British. How are you covering this?
Well, let me – the British, we can talk about it historically and present day, but let's take some of the institutions that have arisen, namely the World Trade Organization. How about that? Mm-hmm. What we ought to do is kill it. We should end it. We should – it's like a, if you look up in your dictionary, zombie, that means – something that's dead but still walks. The World Trade Organization has no respect. It came into existence in 1995 after, prior to that, 10 years of incessant so-called rounds, they call them rounds, by the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT of the UN, all for the polite word purpose of reforming agriculture. They use the word reform, meaning that there should be borderless trade around the world. Nations shouldn't make arrangements between each other as sovereigns. Instead, borderless trade, which really means that very private financial and commodity interests centered in London, in Europe, and really transnationals, that they could just take advantage of all this and control what's produced where, who gets to eat, and that kind of thing. So when we talk about British or the City of London, there's been a fostering of this policy of agencies like the World Trade Organization, that's the most out front one, and other ones, over the last 35 years or so, to undo the kind of moral and scientific commitment that we had say, after the Second World War in 1950, in the middle of the last century, that we should end hunger in the world, that we should create institutions and mobilizations and to encourage, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to, independent nations that could produce food. So it was LaRouche's suggestion, let's let's go for it. Let's end this WTO. And one of the hired hands for the whole thing to be a spokesman is Al Gore, of course. Alternate fuels, biofuels. That's a big part of the food crisis you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. But if you end the WTO, as the WTO, from what you're describing, has a kind of its rules have been feed the market, not the people, so to speak. That you have to conform the production in every nation to some global free market, rather than conforming the production in that nation to feeding that nation or feeding another nation. Get rid of it, and then what should we do? I should just note here, because we're talking about Lyndon LaRouche's response to this. He has out a press release, has for some time. British agent Al Gore is taking people's food away, gets right to the point. And in it he says, every nation must have the right to self-defense against famine, contrary to the genocidal free trade dictates imposed by the IMF and World Bank. Second, a coalition of nations must come together to put measures in effect to increase food production. And third, the biofuel policy pushed by British agent Al Gore must immediately be reversed. What's the key to the nations being able to reverse this drift towards famine and produce more?
Well, a key is going to be to make a break with the going along with any of these axioms that I mentioned over the last 35 years that gave rise to such a thing as the World Trade Organization, gave rise to the idea that the markets are over and above the welfare of people, whether people eat or not. It's true, during these rounds of talks in around maybe 1988 or 9 or something, there was a big round in Montreal, and it's of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and it was called One World, One Market. So the whole there must be a break in thinking, and we're talking about some government leaders. We're doing everything to make that the case in the United States, but whatever leadership comes forward around the world, China, India, Central America, anywhere, that we should just cancel any more adherence to that kind of idea or the World Trade Organization itself and get to work on these three things you said. Take emergency measures in the national interest and with your neighbors and nearby, neighboring countries. Organize to produce more food as fast as possible as the cycles of your climate and resources will allow. Go for it. And take emergency measures for food relief. So we haven't had – there are a few people speaking out, but besides LaRouche, I mean, some people denouncing biofuels. There was a United Nations – I think he's the rapporteur for human rights or for food – right to food, named John Ziegler. I think he said it's a crime against humanity that we should have had biofuels. But we have to have this break.
Well, just one more. I want to ask you one more question and then talk with Rob a bit. You mentioned John Ziegler. He's one of the scientists. I mean, we had 40 years of what people call the Green Revolution, most famously Super Rice and breaking through the barriers to food production per person around the world by a concerted effort which set up institutions and tremendous amount of investment and effort was put into the development of new varieties and the frontiers of agricultural research. What happened to that?
Right. By the way, we may have a confusion. Ziegler, I come from Pennsylvania. Everyone is named Ziegler there.
Oh, okay.
There's a Bob Ziegler who heads the International Rice Research Institute.
That's who I thought you were talking about.
He's yet another person who's speaking out. Good. And the Philippines, it's based, and it was set up in the 1960. Yes, there the scientists and more of the average citizen, as well as other leaders at the time – after the Second World War, at the time, say, up in Quebec, when the World Food and Agriculture Organization was set up, FAO, and Eleanor Roosevelt was very active in that. It was generally known, the scientific principle, that you could work at increasing productivity per unit area of our planet. And the one thing is take how much more cereals grain you might get out of it, rice, wheat, or corn. So the Green Revolution is just an emblematic, wonderful story of how it was, I think, 1941, the election took place at the time of the gathering war, shadows of war. And Henry Wallace, who's a crop geneticist from Iowa, was elected vice president with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But he didn't have anything to do before his inauguration. So he took his Plymouth and drove with very little security personally throughout Mexico, looking at cornfields because corn originated there. And the yield was terrible. So when he went back to Washington, he knew he wanted to collaborate with Mexican scientists and others to do something about this. And there was no money because of the war effort. He cashed some money from the Rockefeller family, who had looted some of their money from Mexico anyway. They started research. They increased yields per acre by 20 to 40% within a very few number of years, shared that around the world after the war. The same thing happened with wheat. And they set up a collaboration with Mexico and India because the climatic conditions were similar. And in 1966, 18,000 tons of new wheat seed from Mexico, very high yielding, were sent over to India as an experiment. And nobody wanted to use it who was in the entrenched positions of power because it's too risky. There were hundreds of millions of people. But Indira Gandhi wanted to. A man named Norman Borlaug wanted to, an American scientist who worked on this. He's considered the father of the Green Revolution and was based in Mexico City. And a very courageous Indian minister of agriculture. And they planted it. And within a few years, by 1974, it took hold so well, India became self-sufficient in food. And that was epitomized the whole kind of 1950s and 60s commitment. Indira Gandhi planted it in her flower beds in front of her ministerial palace in order to give some prestige to the experiment.
And has this now been discontinued? Is there a lack of funding? What's happened with, it seems that now food production, grain production per capita is stagnating around
That's
the world.
It. What happened is you had a sequence of shifts, downshifts, degradation in policy in worldwide that goes back to this longtime British Empire kind of outlook, so that this kind of normal collaboration and increase in what you could say, if you look at a graph, picture the 1940s, 50s, 60s, up into the 70s, there were more cereals produced per capita, per person in the world each year. And then came a kind of decade in the 70s of the claim, well, this was just propaganda, that this was a bad thing to do because we were violating Mother Earth and using up her scarce resources and we should quit it. There were books out like Limits to Growth. And even a club form called Club of Rome that put the book out. And there were policies taken to undercut this. That continued in the 1980s, so that even it was said that overabundance is overusing resources. Food should be cut back. There were land set aside projects foisted on the United States and Europe. There were quota systems against so-called overproduction of food in Europe.
This is the WTO connection again.
They hadn't come into being yet, but this was the shift in outlook and ideology that was being perpetrated. And then finally, yes, in the 1980s, during the decade of Maggie Thatcher in England that stood for these axioms involved in the WTO, that nations should not have sovereign government rights to make decisions about their agriculture or industry or infrastructure. It should be let to so-called private market forces. And then during this time period in Uruguay, a new round of a United Nations effort called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, for so-called reforming agriculture was started in 1984. And over the last 20 years, 1988 to the present, one marker for the condition of the world is less grains, rice, wheat, rye, you name it, anything, has been produced per capita annually every year for 20 years. And there are many other. Africa came to be producing less of all kinds of food in Africa and more dependent on imports, but then without the money, you don't have the food. So you've had an increase in hunger to the point of close to a billion people by the turn of the century, by 2000, 800 million anyway. And that's where, with that as the backdrop, to then start proposing a mass shift into biofuels, taking actual food capacity and food stocks and distilling them into biofuels, that's genocide.
Rob Ainsworth in Montreal, there's a Montreal Gazette article out today. The headline is, "It's time to scrap the ethanol boondoggle." Is there a shift? I know LaRouche has been talking about the threat of famine causing a backlash against the biofuels bubble, as we denounced it 2 years ago. Is there a shift going on in the way it's being thought about?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing in Canada here, from what I understand, the ethanol swindle, it didn't really take off so much. You know, it may also be the case that this is a reflection of the, I mean, Montreal is a very ethnically diverse city, you know, and this may be reflected in the paper. You know, but one thing that we've been noticing is that more and more people right now, you know, they hear about this food crisis, and I think this is also reflected in the press. Most people aren't really for genocide, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, I think when the numbers that we've been publishing, that about 110 million tons of food were going to be put towards ethanol, this year, this has really been shocking people. So, yeah, I would say that that the tendency, of course, within populations is to respond to the needs of the third world. But of course, if our governments aren't going to take measures in that direction, you know, we can put out these kinds of statements and say nice things. But in the end, we're going to have to organize our leadership in order to take the proper measures.
Yeah, there are a lot of others. Business Week has a headline today, or yesterday, "Pressure Grows on the European Union to Ditch Biofuels." there's one out in the Guardian of London. "European Union set to scrap biofuels target amid mm-hmm. fears of food crisis." There's one in the New Statesman, "How the Rich Starved the World," which is a really a denunciation of the biofuels bubble. Marcia, we put out something on this a couple of years ago. How has this thing, it's taken only 1 year, a little over 1 year, and already the bubble is collapsing?
Yes, in fact, when Mr. LaRouche himself and collaborators around the world and the LaRouche Youth Movement, when the newly elected Democratic Congress came in January 2006. We did a lot of, that would be 2007. We really went to town to expose the scientific fraud of ethanol and gasohol. It doesn't matter, corn, cane, whatever you're talking about, to expose the lineage of this, the pedigree, that it's just warmed over Malthusianism from London. In fact, Rob knows a lot about that. I think he wrote about that to educate the Congress. And we went to town on it. That was at the same time Al Gore was coming to speak to the Congress with his whole, we have to save the planet with things like biofuels and saving polar bears. And that built on what we had done during the election campaign in June 2006. Exposing this. So we've had a tremendous drumbeat of getting out the word of what a swindle it is. Now, for the first couple of years, well, let me put it differently. Around 2005 is when some major national laws were passed that allowed a financial bubble to develop, which is pretty much gone, but it also allowed all this shift in acreage that shows up in the food shortage. The United States passed in 2005 the Energy Act of 2005. France passed a similar act that year. Other key nations passed them to say that in certain near future years, what volume of biofuels you must have blended into your gasoline. In the U.S., it's mostly corn and ethanol. In Europe, it's on a smaller scale, but they process oil crop seeds into biodiesel. And in Asia, what happened over the same time period was the use of palm oil and other oils by Cargill in and around Indonesia and Philippines and elsewhere. And then that biodiesel was shipped to Europe. So with only in only about a 2 or 3 year period, what happened is that the beginning of the process I'm describing, this was the new financial mini bubble. Bill Gates invested in it. A lot of lesser-known names did. The number of ethanol factories in the United States went from 34, maybe in the 1990s, up to over 120 now. Iowa's the biggest state. And what happened is that the Bush administration, on the one side, with people like Mr. James Woolsey, I think he was formerly head of the CIA and so forth, said, and George Shultz of California, the economic hitman, we have to have this kind of ethanol because it's for energy independence. Then on the right side, you got Al Gore and others going around, say we have to do it to save the planet and prevent whatever they say. So you had in the Americas, a biofuels conference of the Americas set up 4 years ago. Al Gore went down to Argentina, Brazil. Jeb Bush is the big guy involved in the Bush family. And this took on a tremendous institutional form, but on the ground has been an amazing, deadly conversion of land into corn for biofuels. This year, over 25%, if not 30%, of all the U.S. corn harvest is headed to go into gas tanks, not in the food chain. Not for livestock feed and not processed for other things. So that's an epic shift. And at the beginning, there was a lot of bio-green smart money, mini-bubble hoo-ha about it. Now, with corn prices much higher, not just because of shortages, because with the financial collapse you already spoke about, Paul, One of the remaining casino opportunities still open is to go on these agriculture commodity exchanges, since you can't speculate in home mortgages anymore. You can go to the Chicago Board of Trade. So that crazy stuff is going on. And the prices have spiked for corn and other commodities. And so ethanol may not appear to be such an automatic boom financially. But the wreckage is very extensive, and it's the Corn Belt of the U.S., and it's the Cane Belt that's being rapidly expanded in Brazil.
I guess this is why Al Gore right now, the last few months, you don't hear him talking about biofuels. But, Rob, you and the limb up there took him on when he first started his Nobel Prize procession, whatever it was, or his Oscar procession. And as Marcia mentioned, you've also written a lot about the Malthusian in possession of British policies on Canada. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is interesting. And it also really brings it back to the issue of the American system versus the British system. Because Malthus was a British economist in the employ of the British East India Company, which really was the empire. And you know, this is something, you know, Marcia may want to talk a bit more about. But Malthus was trying to promote the idea that overpopulation, that human population would grow faster than the food supply. and that therefore the poverty of Ireland or the poverty of India, or really any of the British colonies, was due to the fact that there was just too many natives. So the British were actually doing a favor by preventing the natives from expanding at an increasing rate, by preventing them from having the food that they needed, and so on and so forth. You know, but even Henry C. Carey, who is the great 19th century economist of the American system, in one of his first books in 1837, is demolishing Malthus. You know, and saying, in fact, what increases the wealth of a nation is the labor and the improvement of infrastructure and the application of capital to the land, you know, to our factories. And this is really what produces human economies. So the lines are really drawn very clearly that, you know, real American patriots have always understood that anything that stinks of Malthusianism is a fraud and is really coming out of Britain. And Al Gore, in his book from 1992 called Earth in the Balance, is very explicit on this point when he discusses the situation in Africa, that the problem is always overpopulation. And when it comes down to it, this is the issue behind global warming also. But, of course, this is just completely absurd. The real issue is the underdevelopment of the population around the world. You know, as Marsh is talking about, a deliberate destruction of the productive powers of the labor force, you know, to turn the third world into the export zone and the first world into the import zone, you know, so that we can't afford to buy the stuff at a certain point. And we see that now in this breakdown crisis, that the American population has bankrupted itself trying to maintain a standard of living that it cannot even afford anymore, even with the exploitation of so many nations. You know, and so this is really what Gore represents. You know, he represents a genocidal policy that says that the solution to the crisis is simply to reduce the world population, maybe by as much as several billions of individuals. And in the current food crisis, as EIR has reported, approximately one-seventh of the current human population does not have access to the food that they need, and this famine is only beginning. So it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see where this thing would go, especially if we don't get some kind of concerted effort from governments to deal with the crisis. You know, people can look back at this article which I wrote last year called, you know, Al Gore's Green Genocide, and really look at how this policy that Gore now represents has always been a British policy, and it's been always directed against the majority of humanity to prevent them from having the means to improve their own lot in life, to keep them in a situation where they're dependent upon British trading cartels, British banking cartels, raw materials cartels for their subsistence.
Your article that you just mentioned, Al Gore's Green Genocide, mm-hmm. that can be found by anyone going to either the www.LaRouchePAC website or the www.LaRouchePub website, and using the search engines on those sites. It's a very important article in the battle against Gore and what he represents that we've been waging the last 2 years. He's also the heir of the family that owned the mine that Tennessee Williams made infamous in his song 16 Tons. Al Gore looks it, but he actually did. He actually did inherit that mine. I think it's not in the family anymore, but it was up to the time that he was a young man. And so that 16 tons enslavement to the company's store is a direct story of his family. Now, I should want to ask one more question here, because you're talking about the British, and when we think of famine in the last 200 years history, we think of the British. They did it to the Irish in the middle of the 19th century. They did it in India, which had not had famines before or since. They did it for 150 years in India, up to the point that India got its independence at the end of the Second World War. And there's a report out right now by a bank, a London bank called HSBC, in which they even take the current famine developments and food riot developments, and they put out a 50-page report which essentially says, let them riot, that this is part of the adjustment process necessary for the functioning of the free market in order to get food production to increase, and therefore, if riots are part of it and famine is part of it, bring it on, because that's the way the free market adjusts. So we've got the London strategy, and I want to ask either of you, Marsha or Rob, or either of you, how do we beat this? How do other countries beat this now? What's LaRouche proposing as a political action strategy in this crisis? I should mention before I do that you're listening to the LaRouche Show for Saturday, April 19th. We have the next webcast that Lyndon LaRouche is going to be presenting in Washington, the next meeting he'll be speaking at, which will be webcast May 7th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. That's an important date to and time to mark down. So with that reminder, Marsha, what is it that can be done? What's LaRouche demanding? We have an email in that's come from one of our listeners, for example, who says, why would it not be possible for countries such as Argentina, Brazil, and China to team up? I guess he's naming some of the big agricultural producers and exporters normally, to team up and provide smaller and weaker countries the means to deal with their food supply problems. What is it? Can that be done, or how does it have to be approached?
Well, I'll say two things just on that. And, of course, Rob's out there organizing people to make it all that's what we're doing, trying to make it all happen. One thing is let's not underestimate the way that people are still captive to wanting to think that recent decades of creating the conditions for a huge famine, not just regional lack of food, that this is not misguided. It was deliberate, and it's enforced. It's enforced by threats of assassination, bringing people down, scandals. These British circle cartels that Rob mentioned, you're talking about Cargill, Monsanto, and all of the rest, the kinds of destabilizations that they do against leaders goes right along with what we see on a world scale of warfare, trying to totally use Zimbabwe as a way to bring down all of Southern Africa or Sudan, or to use that, or use the Tibet issue to bring down China and India. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous terrorist kind of operation to stay in line. And apropos the question, the email you just read from someone saying, why can't these certain countries get together like Brazil and India? Sure, it'd be a good idea, but I'll give you an example. The president of Brazil just this week, Mr. Lula da Silva, he reiterated that it's wrong to say that biofuels can't be done responsibly. He recommitted himself publicly to say we have to go with this. It can be done properly. It won't hurt everyone, and on and on. He's under tremendous pressure out of London about himself, his country, his loved ones, his people, his homeland. So I'm not saying it's hopeless. I'm saying the other way around. Whatever initiative can come from Denmark, Canada, the United States, we all, as an international association of patriots of our respective countries, have to try and create the climate to force it out somewhere. We're committed to force it out in Washington, but to force it out somewhere that people break with these shackles of this kind of, you have to have markets, you can make markets fair, we should have a level playing field, all that 40 years of crap. And someone call. It can be a state legislator. It could be the premier of Manitoba. I just made that up, Rob. I'm not, you know, who said, forget it. We're going to call a summit of whoever will represent their respective nations. And we're going to we want to make ad hoc emergency food relief measures. We want to discuss how we can have a kind of equivalent to a wartime food production mobilization for the next cycle. of putting crops into the ground. It's that kind of thing we have to force. We're doing that now during an election period in the United States. This ain't no usual election period. It's come after the financial system has collapsed, and now we're looking at total economic breakdown, I mean actual of necessities. So you can't get around that. And that's why I want to put in one plug here, Paul and Rob, I'll tell you, to back up what you said about Al Gore's green genocide. We're putting out the ammunition in Executive Intelligence Review, or what we're putting to bed tonight in the for the printing presses next week and to go online on Tuesday, that is, in LaRouchePub.com, is we're reprinting Henry Carey's actual attack on the British Empire. He does it by name. How this British Empire works and why it's wrong. We're reprinting what Sun Yat-sen said in Asia, why the British Empire is wrong. Because we have to get people to see that we have to overthrow the last 40 years of this increasing neo-British Empire imperialism that's presented itself in the form of globalization. I don't want to take all the time. It's just that, look at Cargill. They're privately held. They're part of the very few, you could call them big grain, like big oil, but they also own steel and salt and everything else. Their profits increased 86% over the last year. They say we're doing great. They run their Africa operations out of London. I brought quotes to the show. Not that I can read them at all, but Cargill has repeatedly said out of London, their executive for African operations, that they said, quote, governments in Africa have fallen into the habit of attempting to set prices, especially food and currency prices. This has been a recipe for economic disaster. Governments are awful at trying to guess what farmers should do or be paid or what the price of bread should be. That's the head of the African operations for Cargill speaking in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So we just got to end it. And we're creating the climate for the initiative to be made of people to respond to what LaRouche is calling for.
The Malthusians like Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute, Al Gore, lately the Chancellor of Britain while he was here, Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of Britain, the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, they all blame this on the Asians. They say the Asians, the Indians and the Chinese, and they have Lester Brown, they've been doing this for some time, for 10 years at least, more, that the Indians and the Chinese are just eating too much. Mrs. Merkel says the Indians are actually eating two meals a day now, and this was not expected. And how could we not have a food crisis with the Indians eating two meals a day? And as she added, with the Chinese drinking milk, how could we not have a food crisis? How do they get away with blaming this on Asia? Is this the rice question? Is this pure British lying involved in this? What is it that's driving the prices up?
Well, I think it's pure British lying. I'll let Rob talk about that.
Okay.
But there isn't. We are underproducing worse and worse every year. That's obviously what it is. So the
so
British.
In other words,
are,
even if we were to, I don't mean to interrupt, but even if we were to, if this famine-driven shift, political shift, destroys biofuels, and even Nancy Pelosi takes down her special select committee on biofuels and so forth, we're still underproducing.
We should be producing at least double the amount of grains. I'm only using as a marker, but that because it's a staple food and you need it for the feed chain for livestock to eat as secondary consumption as well as primary as cereals. So it's just you take Africa has been forced to be a net importer of food and to supply not just tropical goods but mid-latitude goods to Europe. Just like the United States has become food dependent for much that it's was once that could be produced quite well, like the 30% of U.S. apple juice consumption comes from China. So we have terrible dislocations that have been forced by the cash cropping and world free markets, so called, by these those who dominate trade. And that's what has to be ended and phased out.
Rob, can Canada produce more grains? And what have been the major influences that have caused the problem up there? LaRouche is not saying that Canadian farmers are being paid too much now for their grains, is he?
I don't think so. I mean, I would say a couple of things on that. Number one, the price of fuel. The farmers up here are going bankrupt just like the farmers in the United States. Even though we may get attacked from, ironically, a lot of third world nations that we subsidize our farmers. You know, they're demanding more austere free trade. Mm-hmm. But, you know, our farmers are going bankrupt just the same. I mean, we noticed this morning that the price of fuel now for a liter of gasoline is about $1.35. That would translate into about $5 a gallon American, approximately, maybe even a little bit more. Whether it's on fertilizers or other things, our farmers are getting killed. But, I mean, we can produce a ton of food in this country and much, much more than we are right now. But it's just like in other countries. I mean, you just look at the population. People don't want to be farmers anymore. As a farmer, I mean, you can barely make it. I remember when I interviewed one of the directors of the Canadian Wheat Board, and I asked him about the foreclosures that were happening on farms. And he said, well, you know, every year there's a brochure is sent around in all the different farm communities, which has the details of different farms that are selling off their capital stock and so forth as they're closing down. He said it used to be a little brochure, but now it's turned into a catalog. And when you think about rebuilding this capacity, well, this is something that takes, for a high-technology farmer, farm-based operation, you're looking at, you know, a generation. It's just like any skilled labor. It takes a long time to rebuild this capacity. But if we really had the intention to do it, we would, and we can. Unfortunately, with Canada, and we see this with the population all the time, we need to get this shift in the United States. And I think this goes back also to the question that was posed earlier on why different countries couldn't get together to solve this. Unless we get the shift in the United States, it's really going to be impossible to make anything else function, either because Cheney is going to sabotage it, or in the case of Canada here, you don't have that revolutionary quality to the culture that will allow the kind of great leadership that LaRouche represents to step forward and to mobilize that within people. Like, even though the average American probably does not know who Henry C. Carey was, what Henry C. Carey represented will resonate in that individual much more profoundly than, say, in your average Canadian who does not have that same kind of tradition. So, you know, that's kind of what we're facing here. I would say a couple things, though, which also go to the matter of how we organize ourselves out of the crisis. Because when you talk about the British Empire, and we had a call last night amongst the different locals in the United States and also ourselves here in Montreal, just as an overview for the past week of what's been happening, how the population is intersecting or responding to what we're doing and so forth. And one thing that keeps coming up is that there's a major disorientation within the population as a whole. They don't really understand what we mean by the British Empire. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had been thinking about this a little while ago. Part of the problem is that when we think of empires, we think of these large land-based imperial powers. They've got armies all over the place occupying their colonies. But in fact, that was never the basis of the British imperial system. You know, it was always a financial empire and a corporate empire, you could say. And that's best seen in the British East India Company, a private company that goes out and wages a perpetual war against the nations of South Asia. So, and that's very important to bring when we're out intersecting the population. Even here in Canada, you'd be amazed. You'd think more people here would get it, that it's the British. But in fact, they don't, even less than in the United States. Hmm.
But with this coming down now, with this financial empire having crashed, if we can get rid of the tentacles of the WTO on food production, the rules that prevent nations literally from trying to produce enough food for sufficiency, then, Marcia, what are the potentials? How rapidly can this be rebuilt? For example, LaRouche, as I mentioned, is down in Mexico now, and he's meeting with people who want to get going in Mexico a large national water project. And it seems to me that's part of water for the whole North America. It's a water question for all of North America that LaRouche is really working on down there, water and irrigation. How rapidly can nations increase food production with this?
Yes, I think the economic geography could really go, things could be very rapid. It's a question of rebuilding the industrial strength to provide the inputs for the terraforming, you know, for the water management systems and other, or the railroad transportation to be built, the levees, you're right. Give an idea. I think LaRouche is meeting with dozens and dozens, a couple hundred youth from different parts of Mexico today in Monterrey. And I think I heard that he used the expression, in the next 50 years, we could change the planet. Those youth will be around the next 50 years, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. And they'll still be young. They won't be that old. They'll be young old by the time they're in their 70s. And he also stressed culturally the beauties of the past will be continued and protected and be the basis for new creative breakthroughs during the next 50 years if we get to work in the physical geography, physical economy and geography because of the work the youth are doing. But you could take North America, look at a continent, just take a continent or two. In Mexico, right. Fortunately, the plans already exist. They were worked out in the 1960s. For if you look at the southern part of our continent, you have the Sierra Madre ranges on the west and east sides, and you have that runoff there, that precipitation. Then you have the big runoff down in Chiapas and very southern part of the state. And all you have to do on the western slopes is channel that northward up into Sonora. And on the eastern slopes, channel that tremendous runoff that otherwise you've seen in those terrible floods in the east into the Gulf over the last 12 months. And so those plans already exist. You might update them because of technology. So LaRouche was meeting with the big activist group of farmers, trade unionists, and others from Ciudad Obregón and elsewhere. So that's ready to go. I mean, ready to get underway. And that's just the southern part of our North America. We have up in Canada and Alaska the channeling of waters from those basins that flow, that otherwise the Mackenzie water that flows northward into the Arctic. That was literally planned in the 50s and 60s. So it's entirely a political matter to get it started. But these initial plans, like the 1940s wartime plan for where a railway link could go from Alaska to the lower 48 states through Canada, they already did at least the initial survey. So unfortunately, because of what we've talked about, the neo-British Empire that was reimposed over the last 35 years on the world's productive base, if we start to lift that, you certainly could get back to food self-sufficiency within a few years. I think that's true even with the problems we discussed. But then you could go from there to literally start upgrading the food production base. Take Africa. We won't do all continents. That's not the issue. But that they have take the largest nation of Africa. It happens to be Sudan. It's the one that's being targeted for British imperial-type destabilization. Their arable land base that you can cultivate is equivalent to half of all the arable land, cultivated land in the United States. That's a tremendous asset. They're using less than 17% of it because mm-hmm. they just need water. So that could be taken care of in the upcoming years. So those are just two indicative examples of the fact that it's not physical impediments.
And Rob, in your discussion last night, what did you come up with in terms of making this sharper for people?
Well, you know, in the end, I think the way that we're going to defeat this is what our youth movement in the basement is doing and what our locals are doing all around the world in the classes that we're giving on science and art. Because in the end, the issue is really empiricism, that is sense certainty, or what you see is what you get. And the total destruction of the educational systems, you know, in the West, so that people, they don't really know how to think anymore. But when you can bring them a higher conception, not only of their own nature, but also a much more powerful way of thinking, well, you're going to have a population that is not going to fall for these British tricks, but is going to be able to think in a clearly. You know, and for example, you know, you see a forest on fire. Do you look at these trees and say, well, this is just a statistical accumulation of burning trees? Or do you think that, well, this is a forest fire. This is a, you know, this is a single process that's unfolding right now. And so this is really what is going to allow us to defeat these guys. And our youth movement going out onto the street and educating on a daily basis thousands of people on this very issue is what is going to turn the corner. You know, and when we're going into the Congress and sitting down with aides and congressmen or senators are up here sitting down with members of parliament and talking to them about Johannes Kepler and how Kepler determined the nature of the orbits, this is really what it's about.
Well, again, they keep the British line has been, we're producing as much food in the world as can be produced, right? The Malthusian line has been, mm-hmm. we're producing all that can be produced, and it's simply a matter of there are too many people trying to eat it. Marcia, there's other things involved in this too, right? Like not only research, but also the way in which under WTO there's been different kinds of crops introduced, different kinds of
oh, it's a mess. In other words,
spread of soybeans all over the place,
yeah, right.
For example.
Speaking of what you see is what you get, let's look at what we got here that's supposedly the basis for saying you can't produce more food or feed more people. During literally that 1600s to 1870s or whatever of the British Imperial – of the British East India Company, when they said what parts of the world should grow indigo, what part should grow jute, what part should grow that's what we've had here in the last 30 years. So Cargill and Monsanto, ADM, DuPont and others, Bunge, have said Brazil and Argentina, they should produce a lot of soybeans. And Cargill and ADM and Bunge will process them in Mitsui and we'll ship them to Japan and we'll make a bundle off it and they'll be our neo plantations. So at present, 45% of the arable land of Argentina that once was diversified in wheat, cattle, and fruits and vegetables, 45% of it is in soybeans. So you have a huge soy monoculture up through into Brazil. And this also means on a world basis, you have vulnerability to the usual microbes, diseases, and you had a Asian soy fungus move in a few years ago and spread itself all over this area and move up with the storm winds through the Caribbean, and it's now in all the southern U.S. states. Doesn't like the cold weather, it might not go north too far, but so on a world basis, this vulnerability, this increased presence of disease is all gone along with these few select empire-type companies deciding what's going to be produced where for the purposes of their control, not just their greed, but their control. But now, with the kind of reality shock that some people have, the population in general, some other leaders, there can be a chance to break with what allowed this to take place to begin with, you know, the thinking that this was just market forces that was making all these decisions.
Well, the head of the Food and Agriculture Association, Mr. Diouf of Senegal, has, in light of what you're talking about, he's been making statements that the most important matter that should be on the agenda of the UN Security Council right now is the food crisis, that there should be international emergency meetings of countries. Is this what LaRouche is looking for? Is this a real break in the situation?
If you could, well, there again, it's amazing that it hasn't taken place if you look at the degree of danger, isn't it? It hasn't. The UN Security Council, I just checked 2 hours ago. And if it would, sure, this would be the kind of thing to look for. You have the LaRouche Youth Movement, the Helga Zepp LaRouche organizing in Europe and elsewhere, collaborators in Russia. There should be this summit. And that's what we're pushing for, that, collaborative emergency measures. And food is one of the most immediate and obvious things. It's the kind of thing LaRouche has stressed in recent months and years you need, because the financial system is gone. So if we're going to have any economic activity, as expressed by producing food, we have to have this kind of collaboration.
We've had our monitor was down. It's now come back up, and we've had a couple of more emails come in, and they're asking, have any of the presidential candidates said anything on this with the EIR special reports coming out the last couple of weeks, obviously in part aiming at an impact on the big political battle in the United States. Have any of the presidential candidates moved at all on this?
I might have missed it, but I didn't see anything, for example, in the Pennsylvania arena, which, of course, the election is Tuesday. And we'll see.
Okay. Rob, anything breaking up there from elected officials from any of the parties?
Well, you know, Canada is pretty much a mess at this point politically. The system here is frozen pretty much. Nobody's really saying a whole lot. We've got this disaster in Afghanistan, which is going nowhere. And, our forces are totally stretched to the limit. Probably we're going to be, if things get much worse economically, and there is news now that the housing market in Canada has started to tank. Home sales are down 13% now over the last year, and they just dropped 7% over the winter alone. We're probably going to end up going into an election over this summertime. Mm-hmm. So, of course, in a parliamentary system, the government can dissolve at any time, and a month later we'll have a new government, but maybe for 2 or 3 months after that, the new government won't even be able to do much. They'll be working things out and arranging who will have what position. So, right now we're pretty much a write-off, and that's, again, why it's absolutely imperative that we get the breakthrough in the United States. And, of course, with what LaRouche is doing, this is the arena where we have the highest potential.
Well, let me just reiterate in closing, or actually we haven't brought this up yet in this hour, but in closing, that the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, around which we've been mobilizing the whole LaRouche movement with great impact for the last 7 months now, is and has been pushed by LaRouche from the beginning as only a first step to further steps to solving this kind of a crisis. The Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, just in the last few days, has been passed by another state legislature in the Kentucky Senate, it's been introduced into the Vermont House of Legislatures. It's continuing to expand its impact. That is the first of three steps that LaRouche has specified. The first, through the Homeowner Bank Protection Act, to put the banks under bankruptcy protection and put a firewall around this financial collapse. But the second step, to issue low-interest credits for exactly this kind of agricultural infrastructure mm-hmm. investment while drying up speculation with high interest rates for other things. And the third step, an international agreement centered around, in particular, the United States, Russia, China, and India, those four countries, an international agreement to change the monetary system so that trade and credit agreements are aimed at increasing the productive capabilities for exactly this kind of infrastructure, this kind of food production. So that's the mobilization and the LaRouche-centered developments in the U.S. that I think that Rob is referring to. So we've run out of time for today. This has been the LaRouche Show for Saturday, April 19th. Again, LaRouche in Washington, May the 7th, 1 o'clock in a webcast. Thanks for listening.